thinking better and thinking together about life's most important issues. A place to finally meet in the middle, to think freely and reasonably about the big questions of life. This is Thinker Sensitive. Welcome to another episode of Thinker Sensitive. My name is Ryan Ragazine, and I am honored to be your host. Today, I'm going to be discussing the pursuit of pleasure, which is often confused with the pursuit of happiness. I have mentioned a lot of different philosophers and theologians, great thinkers, on this podcast, which is appropriate because I host a podcast called Thinker Sensitive, a podcast for thinking seekers. It's also important because I think sources are important. And I've been influenced by many different scholars throughout the years. I enjoy introducing people to some of these figures, and I enjoy giving them their rightful due and respect on the show. As a contemporary theologian, I believe that a large part of my job is to take what these great minds have produced, to take all the intricate details and complex ideas contained in their thinking, and simplify them and contextualize them in a way that contemporary audiences can appreciate and understand. Some of this involves taking an idea that an author may have fleshed out and parsed over a span of 500 pages and reducing it to a 25-minute podcast episode, which can be challenging but rewarding at the same time. There have been many great theologians throughout the history of the church and the history of Christian thought. Towering figures, brilliant and beautiful minds, scholars who were proficient in several different languages at once, ancient Hebrew, classical Greek, Koine Greek, Latin, French, and German, scholars who earned multiple doctorates, who were experts in several different fields, economics, history, science, philosophy, linguistics, sociology, mathematics, psychology, who held 10 or 15 or 20 different honorary degrees from the most prestigious colleges in the world, who published literally thousands of works, taught at some of the most distinguished universities on earth, and received countless accolades and awards from various scholastic societies and academic institutions worldwide. But out of all of the great theologians who have walked this earth, none has been more influential, more impactful, than the one I want to talk about today, Augustine of Hippo, or Saint Augustine. You might be familiar with the name because of all the schools that have been named after him, or because of the eclectic city in northern Florida that proudly boasts his name. Interestingly enough, in comparison to his modern successors, Augustine was not necessarily well educated or accomplished academically. In fact, he didn't even know Hebrew. And he never really learned Greek all that well either. Though he wasn't the most educated theologian, he was certainly one of the most influential, especially in the West, in both Roman Catholic and Protestant circles, functioning as both the predominant theologian of the Catholic Church prior to the emergence of Thomas Aquinas, and one of the leading catalysts for the Protestant Reformation, believe it or not. Augustine was born in the middle of the 4th century and lived all the way up until the first third of the 5th century. The Gaste, a Roman town in present-day Algeria, was his birthplace. Having been born and raised in North Africa, you can prognosticate about the color of his skin. This brings up an interesting point that most people today don't realize. A good portion of the early church fathers were African, and probably brown, dark brown, or black. Augustine was no different. He famously served as Bishop of Hippo, now Annaba, Algeria, from 396 to 430 AD, the date of his death. It was in Hippo where he witnessed what he and his contemporaries would interpret as the fall of Rome. Under the leadership of King Alaric, the Visigoths, a Gothic and Germanic tribe, sacked Rome, winning a decisive victory over the legendary empire on the 24th of August in the year 410 AD. This monumental event in world history would inspire the creation of Augustine's magnum opus, The City of God. But today, I want to focus on Augustine's other masterpiece, his Confessions. In this notable autobiography, Augustine chronicles his life history and outlines his personal journey. The young Augustine was preoccupied with two basic human pursuits, the pursuit of truth and the pursuit of happiness. In his fervent pursuit of happiness, and this is something that I think all human beings can relate to on some level, especially when you're young and restless, full of angst and passion as an adolescent or teenager, Augustine ran after every pleasure that he could find, every indulgence that he could get his lustful hands on. Whether the pears from his neighbor's tree or the body of his neighbor's daughter. Like many of us today, Augustine viewed pleasure as a means to the end of happiness. He confused pleasure for happiness. In doing this, he found himself wholly unhappy. His insatiable desires were left unfulfilled. And this is the great irony of hedonism, the pursuit of pleasure, treating pleasure as the means to happiness, viewing pleasure as an end in itself. It always leaves the subject unfulfilled, empty, void. Like money and wealth, and also like fame and popularity, pleasure promises what it can't fulfill. But you won't ever know this until you've tried it. And this is where Augustine's story is so utterly relatable and universal. In many ways, his story is our story. His experience is our experience. It speaks to our existential history in the finitude and fallibility and frailty of our existence. Hedonism, the pursuit of pleasure, is as human as procreation, as survival, as flesh and blood. I'm convinced that all human beings are hedonists in one way or another. That we all possess a hedonistic instinct. That we are hedonistic creatures by nature. This is why I believe that everyone can relate to Augustine's story, to his passionate pursuit of pleasure, to the fruits of such a pursuit, as sour and as spoiled as those fruits may have become. We know Augustine's story well, like the back of our very hands, because we have all experienced it firsthand. We know by experience, and hopefully we have learned and have matured by experience as well. What we learn in the Confessions is that Augustine played the game. The pleasure game that all of us have played in one shape or form. And he left, walked away, wanting. Still wanting. Still desiring. Ever craving. Ever thirsting. He ate the pear from the tree, and he was still hungry. It couldn't satisfy his deepest needs and desires. It couldn't satiate the depths of his soul. What a heart-wrenching realization. What a tragic end to a pleasure-filled story. To realize that the greatest pleasures in the world can't fill that heart-shaped hole in the human soul. To know that all the pleasures in the world, stacked on top of one another, one by one, can't ever lift you to the heights of true and eternal happiness. Can't lift you to heaven like a stairway. Can't raise you to God. After all conceivable levels of debauchery and decadence, after all the parties and the fun was over, after his pursuit of pleasure, his futile pursuit had returned void, Augustine wrote these now famous words, that I know by experience, in my very existence, in my history, in my humanity. Quote, my heart is restless until it finds rest in you, in God, the Prince of Peace, the source of all pleasure, the author of all goodness, the ground and goal of all happiness. In the universal human pursuit of happiness, within the schema of means and ends that I've been discussing recently, hedonism is often the default stance or position that people take. Hedonism, the pleasure principle, is more often than not pursued as the primary means to happiness. Even if most people recognize and know by experience that instant gratification and momentary pleasures can't bring real and enduring joy, peace, happiness, and fulfillment. It's the default path that most people take in their individual journeys toward happiness because it's the most instinctual, most intuitive, most mindless, most thoughtless, most bloody and fleshy, most natural path. Today, in a nihilistic landscape that robs life of meaning, that deprives human existence of hope and purpose, that erodes all values, including objective moral value, hedonism is the go-to option. In some ways, it becomes the most reasonable choice. If everything is meaningless under the sun, then eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. If nothing really matters, then I might as well siphon every ounce of pleasure that I possibly can out of this meaningless and purposeless existence. Not to do so would simply be cowardly. This is where many young people today stand. This is how they view the world. This is the position that they take, the path that they're on, a path that leads to nowhere, but a path that is highly populated and very busy. one that we all have travailed to one extent or another. This popular road to happiness is highlighted in so many different shows and movies today. Maybe most prolifically in the current HBO Max series, Euphoria. Quick disclaimer, I have not actually watched the show, but I have heard enough about it and have seen enough about it to know what it's about. It's a show about hedonism. And from the looks of the main artwork or primary cover photo for the series, which shows a close-up of a girl's face with a tear running down her cheek, a possible foreshadowing of things to come, it seems like maybe the series is somewhat true to life, rightly underscoring the futility of all such pursuits, and the tears that inevitably await us at the end of such a perilous but well-traveled road. There are many other shows and movies that I have seen that help illustrate the decadence and degradation of hedonism. One would be Requiem for a Dream by Darren Aronofsky. This film doesn't pull any punches. In some ways, it represents a modern parable on the dangers of lust. The movie documents the steady decline of four drug abusers who fall deeper and deeper into addiction until their habits nearly destroy them, costing them everything along the way. Their reputations, their dignity, their sense of value and self-worth, their relationships, and their livelihoods. The film captures ever so acutely the addictive nature, the addictive quality of lust. Lust becomes a cancer that spreads wildly and rapidly. See, the funny thing about lust is that it's never satisfied, never satiated. It never goes away. It never leaves us. When a person acts on her lust, for whatever reason, the lust doesn't decrease, but only increases. When a person tries to fulfill his lustful desires, attempting to put an end to them by fully and finally indulging them, oddly enough, instead of putting out the fire, he merely stokes the flame. Lust never subtracts. It only adds. More than that, it multiplies. Lust merely breeds more lust. Covetous just spawns more covetous. This is the irony of lust. Instead of bringing us fulfillment, it confines us to a never-ending state of unfulfillment. Instead of leading us to contentment, it traps us in an endless cycle of discontentment. Through habit and addiction, we train ourselves, program ourselves, to be incessantly unsatisfied, perpetually unhappy. We never have enough. We want more and more and more. We always want something better. We always want what we don't have. We only want what we don't have. We become ungrateful for the things that we do have, unable to find pleasure and happiness in them, unable to find pleasure and happiness in anything. For everything we have, we no longer want. Everything that we get our bloodthirsty hands on, we spoil and ruin. So we become disillusioned with the world. We spiral into a profound depression, a thick gray haze. Our lust lied to us. Our desires failed us. Neutered, impotent, unfeeling, numb. Oh, look what we have become. like a heroin addict who has built up a tolerance for the powerful drug. We jam the needle into our forearm over and over until we finally feel something. But instead of an intense feeling of euphoria, it's the pain of an amputated arm. The loss of something immensely valuable. Something that we had taken for granted in a previous life. The pleasure that we consumed us. Enslaved by our passions, we are soon devoured by them. Now we are left with nothing. This is what the fulfillment of our lust and the end of our pleasure amounts to. Nothingness. A void, an abyss, deep and dark. Hedonistic indulgence never really fills us up. It only empties us out, leaving us feeling hollow or nothing at all. This is exemplified in the moments that immediately follow an experience of great physical or bodily ecstasy. Often sober and tranquil, almost sad, almost mournful, almost peaceful, if it only lasted. What the mindless and singular pursuit of momentary pleasure and instant gratification often leaves us with is an absence of meaning, meaninglessness, a lack of purpose, purposelessness. The path of wanton hedonism ultimately leads us to hopelessness and despair. There's nothing in it. There's no country to dwell in, no home to live in. We live in a world of instant gratification and instant pleasure, where positive stimuli and pleasant sensations, even feelings of ecstasy and euphoria, seemingly await us at every corner and in every waking or sleeping moment. In the modern world of ease and convenience, endless possibilities of physical indulgence ostensibly lie at our fingertips, all around us, everywhere, at every turn, in any fleeting and flashing second. This free, easy, all-inclusive access to pleasure no doubt comes at a cost, the full consequences of which I have already laid out. With that said, like wealth and fame, pleasure is not inherently evil. In fact, pleasure is actually a good thing, a gift from God. This is where St. Augustine took a bit of a wrong turn. We see this in his understanding of the nature and purpose of sex, for example, which I'm not going to get into in this specific episode. But suffice to say, Augustine was too reliant upon Plato. His fusion of Platonic metaphysics with Christian theology resulted, at least at times, in a kind of prudishness that restricted, diminished, and devalued the role of physical pleasure and the importance of the physical body in general in human existence and in God's designs for human life. Sometimes this has led to certain strawman arguments being waged against Christianity. We see this in Nietzsche's critique of a certain Protestant form or Protestant flavor of Christianity, for example. But this is a complicated subject, and it requires much more nuance than I can give at the moment. What I will say is that pleasure is a good thing, but like fortune and fame, it is easily abused and easily corrupted, especially when it is treated as an end in itself, rather than as a means to, or in some cases, as a byproduct or consequence of, the pursuit of a higher end. Broadly speaking, Augustine would agree with this. The devil lies in the details. This is where classical forms of hedonism can educate us a bit. To my knowledge, there were two main schools of hedonism in classical Greek philosophy: the Epicurean tradition and the Cyrenaic tradition. To keep this brief, the latter was more in line with contemporary forms of hedonism: the pursuit of physical stimulation, bodily pleasures, and instant gratification. The former was more in line with the classical principle of moderation over excess, which involved regulating desires, minimizing our sense of need, and thoughtfully directing our lives towards the goals of peace of mind, contentment, fulfillment, and happiness. In some ways, Epicureanism, or Epicurean hedonism, is the opposite of modern hedonism. There is much that we moderns can learn from Epicurus, particularly in regards to the principle of moderation. But that is for another day. Much of our lust and pleasure seeking has to do with desire. We are desirous creatures by nature. We have wants and longings and passions. But as I've tried to establish over the last few episodes, even when a person acquires great wealth, or attains the status of celebrity, or dives face first into a sea of 1,000 different pleasures all at once, she is still left wanting. There is something in the human spirit that is still unsatisfied, something in the human heart that is left unfulfilled. There is something in the human soul, a longing, a desire, that cannot be quenched by the things of this world, an itch that can't be scratched, a flame that cannot be extinguished, a hunger and thirst that nothing in this life can remove or take away. C.S. Lewis, in his seminal work, Mere Christianity, once put it like this, quote, "If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world." End quote. St. Augustine famously put it like this, quote, "You stir us so that praising you may bring us joy, because you have made us and drawn us to yourself. And our heart is disquieted until it finds quiet, until it finds rest in you." Thanks for listening, and we will see you in a couple of weeks.
This episode and all episodes of Thinker Sensitive are available on thinkersensitive.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and more. Subscribe on your favorite podcast app today to listen to more thought-provoking content from Thinker Sensitive.